Welcome to Big Blend Radio, where we celebrate variety and how it adds spice to quality of life. Hey, everybody, welcome to Big Blend Radio. This is going to be part of our Toast to the Arts show because we're going to be talking with award-winning author Clifford Garstang. He's been on our show, I think, even from the beginning of our podcasting journey here on Big Blend Radio. And it's also going to be part of our Women Making History show because he's got some women characters in his latest book, which is called The Last Bird of Paradise. And what's interesting is it really takes us into Singapore in two different eras. And really talks about what two women went through. And I encourage you to go. It's out now. Go to Clifford's website. It's cliffordgarstang.com. So welcome back, Cliff. How are you?
I'm doing great. And it's so wonderful to be with you again.
Yeah, it has been like that long, hasn't it? It's been over 15 years.
Yeah. Wow. Something like that. Yeah.
I was trying to add up all your books today. And then I realized, like, then you have, like, anthologies and short stories. I think In an Uncharted Country was when you first came on the show, I think.
That's right. And so that was my very first book, which came out in 2009, a collection of short stories.
Oh, wow. Wow. We're doing good, aren't we? We're all still here.
Yeah.
I think I love this. I want to go to The Last Bird of Paradise. By the way, it's one of my favorite plants. And related to the banana, I believe, the Strelitzia.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. But this is set in Singapore, and you're always writing about the human condition, I feel. The human struggle, the person, people going through something, going through to the other side. And I feel that way with this story, too. But this is set in Singapore, and you know Singapore pretty well from your legal background, right?
I really do. The first time I went to Singapore was actually before I went to law school. I was living in South Korea and working as a Peace Corps volunteer there, and took a backpacking trip when my job in South Korea was done, and ended up, I think it was 1978, spending a couple of weeks in Singapore as kind of a respite from the hard life of a backpacker, because it's such, even back in 78, it was a pretty comfortable, wonderful city to visit. Now, of course, it's amazing, but back then it was great. And then later, after law school, I had a job with a big law firm, and they sent me to Singapore. So I lived there for almost 10 years then.
Oh, wow. And it's pretty cosmopolitan now, even though it's lush and gorgeous and has so many historical aspects. I think one of the most iconic things that people think about when they think of Singapore are those gardens, those famous gardens. Is it Gardens by the Bay? I think I know one of the travel writers did a story on them in the magazine.
Yeah. So Gardens by the Bay, which I visited when I went for a research trip a few years ago, is amazing, but I still prefer the park that's in your background right now, which is the Botanic Gardens.
Oh.
And in the book, which is set in both 2002 and 1914, both of these main characters visit the park that you seem to be sitting in right now.
That's my bench, by the way. You know. Yeah, that's
yeah, and the Gardens by the Bay didn't exist in 2002. It's a very new thing.
That's why it's not in the background. because it seems like it's always developing. Whenever I look at any pictures in Asia, right? Even I have a friend in Taiwan right now. There's always the cranes of building happening. It's kind of like going to Vegas. There's always a crane, it seems like. And right. And I think, is that what it's like? Because you went back for a research trip, even though you lived there. Are those cranes still there?
It's amazing the construction that's going on. In fact, I gave a talk to a group a few weeks ago where I showed pictures of the city in the various times that I had been there. So I showed a picture of the skyline in 1978, and then a picture when I first moved there in 1983, and then a picture when I moved again in 1990, and then when I moved back or went for my research trip in 2017. And the growth in the city skyline is just amazing. It's remarkable and beautiful and modern.
Yeah, now I kind of like the old school botanical garden. I'm just going to say I like that. Let's talk about the two women and the story of the book, because you're balancing two timelines. You know, you've got the character of kind of the now modern history, right after September 11th, and they go from the States over to Singapore, her and her husband. And she connects with this artist, you know, these paintings. And it's kind of interesting that you go there with that as becoming the story of bringing the two together, because I think sometimes we can just kind of trip out on a painting. You know, a painting can tell us a story, and then you start digging into it. And I remember when Nancy and I moved to Mexico, it was a crazy time. We were helping family members who were sick, and we moved to a house on the beach. It was outside of Ensenada. And the lady's house that we moved into, she had left her stuff. And I was like, this is weird, you know? And she was an expat, and it was the house of the Dead Seal. Now, Jim Morrison in The Doors had actually, there's this song that, like, one song, and he talks about the house of the Dead Seal on the beach in Mexico outside of Ensenada. And I thought, this is freaky, right? And this lady was an artist. So if you walk down the steps into the living room, she had painted the walls as though you're going under the ocean. And then she did have dead seal skulls on the, anyway, this is just, it's weird. But she left a diary of living there. And she had written some book. And I got stuck into reading her diaries because she left them. And I thought, and it was about her actually moving into Mexico. And the stories of me meeting people, but she started to write the characters. So she was basically hanging out with these people to write about them as characters. It was, I, and then it ended, and I was like, well, that sucks. Like, so it kind of, in a way, The Last Bird of Paradise kind of connects with me in that level of how you could not know someone, but you can get really connected.
Well, you know, I love your use of the phrase tripping out with the paintings because in essence that's what happens to the main character, Ashlyn Givens. She first sees some paintings when she's in New York City, which are contemporary paintings that were done by a Singaporean artist who's still living, and who she will later become friends with when she moves to Singapore. But she really enters into the world of these paintings and begins to understand what Singapore is just from the way that these paintings seem to come to life for her. I mean, the fact that she's on pain pills at the time may have something to do with
Tripping out.
the way they come to life for her. But then when she moves to Singapore and she finds these paintings that were done in 1915 by Elizabeth Pennington, the other main character of the book, they also come to life for her. And in a way, I think that it's these women speaking to each other through the paintings, right? In 1914, 15, Elizabeth Pennington is telling her story in her paintings. And it's a story that really speaks to Ashlyn Gibbons in 2002. And likewise, the Singaporean artist Shan Li, who has her own set of problems, is telling that story also. And again, unlike her other viewers, the stories really speak to Ashlyn. There's some kind of connection between them.
It's really interesting. We just did an interview about this kind of connection with artist Victoria Chick, and she was talking about an artist, Artemisia. Oh my gosh, I'm going to have to look up her name in a second so I don't mess up. I can get it right here. It is Artemisia Gentileschi, and she was from the 1500s, and her dad was a famous artist who taught her, and then he sent her off to by another male artist. This woman is an incredible documentarian and just artist, and the guy, the tutor, raped her. And
Oh.
so people don't know about this woman's art as much because the rape overshadowed her art. And but if you look at her painting, she tells a story, and then you see through all these series of paintings and self-portraits, which I think a lot of artists do at the beginning. You know, your tutors tell you to do a self. Didn't you have to do that as a writer too? Write about yourself, tell us about
Oh yeah,
yourself, and you go,
absolutely.
oh God, really? But you can see her go from like innocence to strength, and strength in doing different things like musical instruments, painting, but being very strong. And so you see this storyline. So what led you to write it on this art side of things? Because I think a lot of times women did actually speak in that way because during certain eras we were, you know, to be seen and not heard.
Well, in fact, the paintings were what prompted the whole story for me because in about 1990, when I was furnishing an apartment in Singapore, I bought three paintings by a woman, an English woman who was painting in Singapore in 1917, a little later in real life than I have it in the fiction. And I still have those paintings. They're hanging on my wall now. And I have always wondered first something about her life, which I was not ever able to get a lot of information about, unfortunately, but also about what else was happening in Singapore back then. You know, as I said, I moved there in 1983, and life was very different than it was in the colonial era, and certainly when Singapore was first founded in the 1800s. And so I started researching what was happening. And that's when I discovered the impact that World War I had on Singapore, which I had never realized, even when I lived there. That's not something that people talked about. But then, because I was interested in these paintings by a woman, I was inspired to create this fictional artist who would have seen things differently in Singapore than, say, a colonial man would have seen them.
And to write from a woman's perspective, you—I mean—you've always had that sensitivity, no matter what character, I think, to understand what someone's going through. What do you think? Is it from being an attorney that you understand people a little bit better, can read people? But what is it about you that has this understanding of sensitivity? Like, do you know what I mean about people? Like, you understand people.
Yeah, well, I think so, and thank you. I'm pretty sure it's not from being a lawyer. You know, my clients were banks and corporations, and one of the reasons I stopped being a lawyer was because I wasn't working with real people. I mean, I wasn't, you know,
Yeah.
representing real people. But you know, I've always wanted to be a writer, and I think part of training for being a writer is being a close observer of people. And I do feel like I have empathy, and in a way that I can really understand what people are going through. And of course, we all go through things ourselves, right? So one of my I mean, I often get a lot of questions about how I can inhabit the minds of these different characters. With one of my earlier books, I remember speaking to a college class, and the particular story was about a woman who was addicted to pills, and she was having various kinds of mental problems. And the college student asked me, you know, you're obviously not a middle-aged pill-popping woman, Mr. Garstang. So how do you get into this woman's mind the way you do? And the answer, which I also give for the two women characters in this book, is advice that I received a long time ago from a writing teacher, which was from the book An Actor Prepares by the great Russian director and actor Stanislavski.
Oh.
Who recommends tapping into your own emotions, the emotions that you share with the character that you're preparing to depict on stage, or in the case of a writer, you're going to depict on the page as opposed to the stage. And so I think that's what I try to do. You know, I have experienced loss, so if a character in the book is suffering from loss, I really feel that I can empathize with him or her, and with all the other emotions too, with anger and jealousy and all of those things that all of these characters go through.
In the case of these ladies, in The Last Bird of Paradise, you're also talking about women being in a new country. You've also, being in the Peace Corps and having traveled through being, working with the World Bank and being an attorney, you've experienced different cultures and understand that culture shock and then having to live in what it is now, which is I always find interesting about countries, you're living in it now. And what's going on is shaped from the past and the present at that time. I mean, if we look at all the wars happening right now, all the issues, these are all ancient wars that are still being played out. Nothing has stopped, right? Nothing has actually changed other than now we have the internet. And if you're in Ukraine, thank Elon Musk for it. Maybe not. I don't know. But you know what I mean? So that's kind of how it seems to me. And I think when you travel, do you have a deeper understanding through that? Do you feel that with, especially with this backdrop of Singapore?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that living in the world today, we really need to look through other people's eyes. Or step in their shoes, to use a different cliche, and understand what they're going through. So the book actually has an epigraph from Marcel Proust, which is about this, and it's the way that we need to. The only way that we can understand people is to try to look through their eyes and see the world the way that they see it. So. As you say, really not much has changed because the woman, Elizabeth, in the colonial era is experiencing colonialism from the side of the British, but seeing the impact on the people who have been exploited by the colonizers. And likewise, Ashlyn Gibbons begins to understand that she's really not much different. She and her American compatriots aren't much different from the British colonizers. And the end result, they saw it in 9/11, the terrorist attack, which was really an act of, I would argue, an act of resentment. And it's not too different from what happens in Singapore in 1915, which is also pushing back against the colonizers. So, yeah, not much has changed.
And it's weird. I mean, you know that Nancy and I lived in Kenya during those colonial that colonial era was, I mean, number one, we were one of the few white people, right, where we lived. And women, I was a little girl, and here she is a single mom in Kenya, and all the friends and were all British and ringing little bells for their servants to come. And Nancy's like, hell no, I'm from, America. We don't do this stuff. And, that was a clash. So she actually felt very disconnected from like her age group of expats, or I don't even, you can't even, what are they? I don't, would you say expats then? I don't know what to say about it. But most of them, their husbands were in corporations, and then sanctions came, and then those corporations started closed and things started to get wonky. And it just was a very different lifestyle, but we were kind of always on that outskirt of things because we didn't like, she took 10 years for her to hire a maid or any kind of housekeeper. And at that time, we were getting robbed for not doing it because they wanted you to hire them. And then she had a houseboy and she's like, oh, have dinner at the table. And then all the white people freaked out. This colonial thing is a very odd thing. And it's actually, I love that you bring in women because I think the women's side of it, it's a very hard thing to know what to do in a household,
Well, that's such a great point, and it comes in to this book as well. I mean, it was very common when I lived in Singapore. I didn't need a full-time housekeeper, but I did have someone who came in part-time. Many of the expat couples did have full-time live-in maids. And so Ashlyn and her husband Liam have a live-in maid, a Filipina woman, which was very common, still is common in Singapore. And she doesn't really get the idea of having someone living in her apartment in this tiny little room behind the kitchen. And she kind of freaks out about it. Liam, on the other hand, has these expectations and really entitlement beliefs that he's perfectly happy with having this live-in maid. And when Ashlyn says that the maid might be unhappy about something that he has done, he says, "Well, if she's unhappy, we'll get somebody else," because that's how he feels he can
This is
treat.
so it, right? But this is like 20 years ago, but it's still there,
Yeah, absolutely.
huh? Oh, man, and you think back in when the colonial era was happening. I mean, even the 70s, it was still very prominent, but the women that we knew were very, well, I think the Americans were a little different, a little different. And I'm not knocking anyone. I'm just saying it is what it is. I'm just being honest. I mean, we didn't have bells, and my mom was friends with another lady who was American, and she didn't ring bells. She didn't do that, and was a much more relaxed atmosphere. But so to have that kind of different eras, but so much had happened in Singapore, and so these women were bonding over change in a way, right? Yeah.
Just a little bit more on the colonialism,
Yeah.
because another point to notice is that the locals basically inherited the society that was created by the colonists, and they really adapted to it and sort of became the colonial powers themselves. And I think that's one of the points that I'm making, is that sure, they resented the colonial British, but then they behaved the same way when they took over. And so, I mean, it's very common for wealthier Singaporean families to have servants. And I have not seen the movie Crazy Rich Asians, but I did read the book. And although it's a hilarious book, I don't think it's too far off the mark in terms of how the classes are structured in Singapore. So
Isn't
that's
it
one
kind of
thing.
like that in India too?
Yes,
India is kind
absolutely.
of like it goes by the caste system more than racial. It's like a financial divide more than anything.
But also, just talking about the two women and their connections, they also have in common romantic problems. And they don't, I mean, Ashlyn doesn't have too much information about Elizabeth's romance, but she does have these portraits of two men, and she tries to figure out who these two men are. And in a way, those portraits come alive for her too, and tell her the story of not only how the men felt about Elizabeth, but how Elizabeth felt about the men as she was painting their portraits. And then Ashlyn also, because she has some difficulties in her marriage, she is interested in another man as well. So they have that in common too.
That happens. It happens on all sides. It happens on all sides. I think it's kind of part of human nature, and I feel like if you don't add that in there, it's and I want to get touch on, because I know that you do a lot of interviews with other authors, and so and everyone I follow Clifford on Clifford Garstang on Facebook, right? And you can follow all that those interviews you do. And I was wondering, because I know you do so much reading. I know you help with editing, and you're in the literary world. You've studied it. You've done all ends of it, right? When you're writing, do you have to stay away like from books like Crazy Rich Asians, or do you read them and take what you want from it to help, you know what I mean? It's like musicians sometimes can't list, they'll be inspired by someone, then they have to put them away so they don't kind of copy that style too much in their own music.
Well, that's a really good question. I don't think I am very particular about what I'm reading when I'm creating something new. I don't. So yeah, that's a really good question. So after I was already done with this book, I read the Geraldine Brooks novel Horse, which actually has several things in common with my book. It's about it's a contemporary story, but it's about a painting that was done around the
Wow.
Civil War era, and it is brought into the present, and so people are studying it in the present. So we're getting these two stories at the same time. And I had already finished my book, so that didn't have any influence on me, except when I was writing to publishers and agents, saying, you know, my structure is pretty similar to Geraldine Brooks's structure. But I try not to be influenced by other writers. I guess I am keen to look at other structures that may be helpful, though. When I first started writing this, I asked friends for recommendations of other books that were braided narratives, stories that were in multiple timelines, just so I could see how other people did it. And no one did it the way that I did it exactly. I decided pretty early on that I wanted to make the historical story a diary so that it was very close to the voice of Elizabeth, the woman in World War I. And my only challenge there was to figure out a way to weave that into the contemporary story, which I did by just taking excerpts from the diary and sticking them in a place that sort of made sense.
But
But
diaries, like I said at the beginning, diaries are always like the coolest
yeah.
thing, right? Because you've got firsthand gossip.
Exactly. Yeah. So she's revealing most of her inner thoughts. She does shy away a couple of times from being too explicit about what's going on, but I really enjoyed writing in her voice, first person, obviously, because it's a diary. And so she's seeing Singapore for the first time as a young, very young woman from England.
And for both of them to go through, I mean, this is the thing about, artists, the way they get to have this expression going out, right? So look at your main character. What's her expression going out? Because she's taking in art, she's having conversations, but what is her release? Do you think her release is these connections? That is her way of, because art is a release in a way, right? There's a therapeutic quality. No matter how we look at it, it's like even just that feeling of, okay, I finished this story, or there's just this, it's off the beaten path, no matter how you look at it. I think we all need
Right.
that.
And she tells us early on that she had studied art history and that she thought she might want to study art itself. She has a print of a Georgia O'Keeffe painting in her office, and that really speaks to her as well. She's also a pianist. She had to give up her piano when they moved from New York to Singapore, but she's still listening to music, and so that's sort of an outlet for her. She wishes she had a piano. But you know, in New York, she was a driven lawyer, rising senior associate in a big New York law firm, and she tells us that she loves the law, that it really instructs her so much about power dynamics, which, just to be blunt, is what the book is really about. But she loves the law. And so when she gives that up, because her husband is so disillusioned about New York in a post 9/11 world, and they move to Singapore, she still wants to find something in the law as an outlet for her. And she does, she has an idea about something she might write about the law, but she is able to find a job with a Singapore law firm. And it's not ideal, but she is really keen to keep her hand in the law. This is who she is. That's how she views herself. That's her identity.
She's a justifier, you know, justice. You know? Yeah. Justice will prevail. Yeah, and the law is creative too. You have to have the creativity to make it work, you know, and due diligence. One thing with you is I know you're saying you went to Singapore on a research trip, you lived there, you'd been there before too. But your writing always has sense of place and accuracy, and I know I've brought this up with other, you know, shows with you, but you have this accuracy. Like the beginning, you talk about, you know, Ashlyn being with her husband out in a restaurant in South Africa, and now you're ordering a bottle of wine from Stellenbosch. I'm like, because if you didn't, I'd be like, what are you doing, man? No, because like it's true. Like if you watch a movie and they say it's somewhere else, and it really, you, I mean, it's a it's a Debbie Downer for all of us when that happens, you know? So you really have, and I know you've traveled, but I mean, you really have due diligence on an integrity of what you're writing in sense of place, in historical facts as well. So is that something very important to you that you always double check what you're doing?
Well, absolutely. So the Stellenbosch thing is funny because I really enjoy my wine, and so I have made a
Me
point of
too.
learning about wines from around the world, even though I haven't been to South Africa. I have been to South Africa.
Cliff, you must. You
That's right.
must.
I was in Mexico several years ago at a writing workshop, and there was a woman from South Africa who worked in a winery there, and she had managed, she used the word smuggled. She had managed to bring a case of South African wine into Mexico, and we had this lovely party drinking all of these Stellenbosch wines and various other wines. So that was great.
Some of the
And,
best
but it,
white wine.
in terms of getting things right, yes and no. I mean, the big things you have to get right for sure, but there is artistic license, right? And so when some things about Ashlyn's life in New York, I made sure to get right, like her office building and getting back and forth from Manhattan to their townhome in Park Slope. Those things I felt I needed to get right. On the other hand, when she goes out to lunch and she's walking by a bookstore, I didn't care if that bookstore really existed or not. You know, that didn't seem to matter to me much. In Singapore, I did, it was very easy to tap into my own knowledge of the geography of Singapore to get the streets right and the buildings right and the subways right and that sort of thing. But I did take some creative license with some events. So the book is partly about terrorism, right? And so 9/11, you can't mess with that. There's a reference in the book while they're living in Singapore, there's the 2002 bombing in Bali, which killed 200 people. And you can't really mess with that either. But so I have a terrorist act in 2003 in Singapore that didn't happen, I have to say. And I confess to that in the afterword of the book that I made that one up because I think I would annoy the Singaporean authorities if.
It's what we call them. We call those skirmishes, right, in history. Yeah, that was just a skirmish. Yeah, but I think things happen too. You know, there's things that don't always get, well, now we have the news 24/7, and but we don't know which is what's right half of it. It's difficult, you know. But you know, Yeah, you have to put some things in there that could happen. I mean, we.
And of course, the whole one of the main things, reasons to have the historical story was because of something that really did happen in 1915 in Singapore, the Singapore Mutiny. And so I did a lot of research on that. That was one of the things I spent a lot of hours in the National Library of Singapore researching, was so that I would get that right. And I even used a couple of names from the actual incident of people who were involved. And I wanted to make sure that I didn't overplay that, even though the main people that I have in the story are totally fictional. It needed to feel real. And I think that's mostly true of realistic fiction in general.
And with Singapore being such an international destination, it is, it's international. So many different people coming and going, right? And working there. So it really gives off so many stories just from that, right?
Right.
With all your research, though, did you see how things may have changed for womanhood, seeing that you're on the Women Making History podcast now too? Did things change for women from like 1915 through, to right after, September 11th, 20 odd years ago? Did that kind of change for women from Singapore that you could, and for women going to Singapore, did you see any changes for women? I mean, right now our country is going backwards. So, like, oops,
Right.
did I say that? I did. I can, and I will.
One of the things I discovered doing the research for the book was that reproductive rights in Singapore are far more liberal than they are in this country, which was shocking to me because I consider it to be a fairly conservative city. The government has been paternalistic for a long time. As I said, the locals who inherited the government from the Brits really learned how to do it from the Brits, and so they keep a pretty tight control on things. But it's a fairly progressive place in a lot of ways. And one of the things that Shan Lee, the Singaporean artist who becomes Ashlyn's friend, remarks about is that Singapore has really has opened up. It has flowered. When I first went there in 78, and then when I first moved there in 83, it felt like a really tight, kind of boring place. We used to call it Disneyland because it was so clean and just so controlled, and everything was on a schedule. But now it feels like a much more open place. There are, well, first of all, there are a lot more people now than when I lived there, something like 6 million. There are lots of
That's big. That's a
restaurants
lot.
that aren't just in hotels. When I lived there, the nicer restaurants were part of hotels, but now they're.
Like the Four Seasons was like the place to eat, right? At one point.
Yeah, I mean the big hotels are there, and you go there for the fancy dinners.
Is
But now,
it Rafferty's? Rafferty's with the
Raffles,
single Raffles,
right?
that's it.
Right.
Raffles with the Singapore sling.
Exactly. So that's mentioned in the book in a couple of places, but these days, Shan Lee makes the point that art is a much bigger part of society now. And she's a woman artist who has a lot more freedom than would have been the case earlier. And so, yeah, I think that women's rights have come a long way. Interestingly, I was in, I was in Singapore in January of 2017, which was the Women's March on Washington.
Oh,
And
wow.
The Singapore government doesn't really look too kindly on big public demonstrations like
Right.
that. But there were some events in Singapore to commemorate that day. And so that was interesting too, because it made news. And yeah, so things have definitely changed.
That's cool to know. And like you were saying, even with women's art, you know, because that was always kind of like it was almost a man's world at one point with art. And you know, and you know, just doing this recent show with Victoria Chick, we were talking about Edmonia, Mary Edmonia, I can't remember her last name. I'm going to get it wrong, so I don't want to get it wrong. But I mean, we're talking about women in the 1500s, you know, early 1800s, 1900s, and I mean, even Grandma Moses, it's pretty amazing when you think about these women that were there. And a lot of times, unfortunately, they really only got well known after they'd passed. You know, you have to wait a few centuries sometimes for
Right.
things to happen because it was kind of a man's world. So I think it's really fascinating about these women artists that you're writing about because, yeah, I don't know if it would have happened maybe 100 years ago, you know?
Right. And I wanted to make sure that Ashlyn at least is aware of the world of female artists. So, as I mentioned, she has a Georgia O'Keeffe poster. There's also a Shan Li has a painting that Ashlyn sees that was done by a friend of hers, which is a Frida Kahlo knockoff. It's changed a Frida Kahlo self-portrait into a Chinese woman's face with Chinese decorations instead of what Frida Kahlo has in one of her self-portraits. Yeah, I mean, I think the importance of the emergence of women in the art world is another thing that I'm really interested in this book.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about Frida Kahlo, she really did do self-portraiture, didn't she? Like, she really told her story. Man, she was kind of wild too. Like, if I could sit down and have a shot of tequila with someone, it would be her. Wouldn't you want to sit and like, you know, I can't do shots. You know, I did that as a teenager. I can't do that now. But
Yeah,
I'll
well,
sit. I love tequila, so I'd love to just sit down with her and just. But then, you know, she was wild, man.
I've been to her house in Mexico City
Oh,
a couple
did
of
you?
times. Yeah, it's pretty great.
Oh.
And there's a separate place where you can visit Diego Rivera's studio, but her house is way more interesting than his studio.
We do a lot on the artist Ted DeGrazia out of Tucson, Arizona, and he studied under Diego Rivera and Jose Orozco, and then came over, and he was really like the artist for the people of the Southwest of Tucson area and the Tohono O'odham, and he also got into a lot of kind of the Spanish history too, and the Mexican history. He's very big on that, and so I got kind of more into Diego and Jose Orozco than I ever thought, just because of him, you know, Ted DeGrazia, who's like a Renaissance man, and he would write stories about like Father Kino or Padre Kino coming through, but he was like he was writing it as he almost wrote the guy's biography as though it was him, like it was he wrote it like a not it was bizarre, like he was not bizarre, but like just. This guy had no limits of creativity, from painting to writing to even making his own films about his art and stuff, and being a musician too, you know.
Oh.
So it's kind of interesting. Yeah, he's you should write him in a book, you know. So,
Well, you know,
you know.
the these paintings that come alive, it's not the first time I've done that. I have a story that was in my last story collection, which is called House of the Ancients and Other Stories, in which I used some of the time that I spent in Mexico as a backdrop. And so these two characters, a couple from Chicago, are in Cuernavaca, and they're visiting a historical site where there is a mural by one of the great Mexican artists, and it comes alive, telling the story of really rebelling against the conquistadors. And Mexican art is needs to be better known.
And there's so much symbolism. I've told this story on the show before. When we lived in South Africa, you know, I was working with Nancy in the magazine, but I also, as a late teens, started a jewelry company. and was a jeweler. And I actually can't wear jewelry. I'm allergic to metals. And I don't care what carat gold, it just isn't going to happen. I can't even wear like sunglasses. I have to be careful. Watches, all of that. Like no metal for me. Yeah. But anyway, I was got into beadwork, and I actually ended up not doing it anymore. I got so interested in telling the stories of the beads and the history, like the cowrie shell was used in slave trade, and all of this stuff, that I actually went down a rabbit hole that was so big that I was like, all right, I better just go work in the magazine world, because then I can have all these rabbit holes that I want. But like all the colors mean different things. And in, Mexican art and in African art, a lot of times there'll be these hidden symbols and colors that mean something. And I also find, like what you're talking about, also Asian art too. Asian art is really interesting, how they it's some of it is very flat, yet it isn't flat. Do you know what I mean? They've done such an amazing, it tells the seasons, but there's also folklore behind a lot of Asian art that to me I find really fascinating. But how they do that kind of flat work that's not flat, that makes no sense, but I'm just saying, you know what I mean?
I do, and one of the things that I love about art, and which is why it shows up in my writing a lot, is that no matter what the artist is depicting, whether we can even understand what the artist is depicting, I feel like there's a story being told. And whether it's something that's drawn from folklore, or if it's a cultural symbol, or whatever it is, I love to stand in front of a painting and try to figure out what the heck is going on.
Some is really bold, and some of it is like you're just, and I feel like the arts are always telling the truth, right? That's always the truth. The arts, whether it's books, novels, historical fiction, is always kind of telling the truth of what people are going through at a certain era of time. Music does it, art. I think artists who have integrity to whatever they're trying to say. And it's up to us to kind of guess it out, and we create our own stories from it too. A song that was written about maybe, I don't know, one, whatever the story is about, we could take it and make it our own completely, which is this co-creative experience. Do you feel that as well when you write, that there's going to be something that the characters do that you resonate with that just feels like home to you and can build onto something else?
I mean, that goes both ways too, because I create the story, the characters develop it really for me. They do what they do with my help, and but then the book is published, and now it's the reader's turn to engage with these characters, and it may become something totally different now because something resonates with their life or their interests, and I have no control over that. So the reader is bringing something completely different to it. And so for example, a colleague of mine who I worked with in Singapore read the book as soon as it came out, and he was loving it, and how it was taking him down memory lane, and how he really enjoyed seeing these places where he had lived. He only lived there for a couple of years, but still. On the other hand, I have lots of friends who've read it who have never been to Singapore, and now they want to go to Singapore because I think I did a pretty good job of making it an interesting place. So.
Do you feel like, have you done book clubs at all? Because like even like you coming on the show, like I try not to be, it's so hard because even with music and books, you don't want to tell this, you don't want to give it away, and it's like one thing, and I've learned over the years, like, shut up, Lisa. Just because you want to talk about this character to death does not mean someone who has never read the book knows what the heck you're talking about. So it's like two different conversations, So do you ever do clubs where people who have read the book can now just, everybody knows what everyone's talking about, and it's a free for all, and you get
Yes,
to hear
and
this other side?
I totally love doing that. really so interesting to be face to face with people who've read a book and get their reactions and figure out how to answer their questions, because yeah, it's hard sometimes. You don't really want to tell people what the book is about. It's one thing to talk about the plot and another to talk about the theme and that sort of thing. Just last year, I was invited to a book club that was reading an older book of mine, one that came out more than 10 years ago, What the Jong Boys Know.
Oh,
And I actually had to
you had
not.
to teach me how to pronounce that. I remember that.
I have to do that with everybody.
I
So,
thought it was a zang. I remember that.
but I had to reread the book before I went to that book club
Oh,
because,
wow.
I mean, 10 years is a long time. And it was really great to get their reaction and a little pushback from some of the people because it had some dark themes and they didn't like the dark themes. And so, yeah,
But that's
anyway, it
life.
it's really fun to do book clubs, and I'm hoping to do. I think this will be a great book club book. There's a lot to talk about. I think the women will attract a lot of people. Some women may be angry with one of these women, but that's okay. It's something to discuss. I think there's a lot to talk about.
A little fire is good. Now, the last bird of paradise, you want to say, tell us about the title, or is that for a book club? Because I, you know, there's something there, the bird of paradise. Oh gosh, there's that song, "May the bird of paradise float up your nose." That's not a good thing. We're not talking about that. That's a whole other thing. But the bird of paradise, I grew up with them in Kenya. Like, just they were everywhere. You get them on the coastal areas, like in San Diego, and they're most beautiful, beautiful. But they're pretty resilient too, as a plant. So, I mean, obviously there's, a botanical garden setting too, but tell us about the title.
Yeah, so one of the things that attracts Elizabeth in her artwork is the lush gardens that surround her uncle's house. So she's living with her uncle in Singapore, gets there in 1914, and she's painting what she sees. One of the paintings that Elizabeth Ashland buys is a painting of a temple. So that's one of the things that she paints. But she also paints the bird of paradise flowers that she sees in the garden. And she's really entranced by the flowers and how they seem to be, I mean, they're taking flight, but they're also like flames that she can hold in her hand. And they're really, really bright. And she relates them a little bit to her relationship with this British soldier that she develops and sort of the burning passion that they have for each other. And eventually, although Ashlyn doesn't buy one of the Bird of Paradise paintings, she sees one later that's in her office in the law firm that she gets a job with. So the Bird of Paradise flower is one of the reasons for the title. But also, so Ashlyn grew up in Virginia, and her father was a veterinarian who treated exotic birds, and so she's very fond of birds. And she has in her apartment in Singapore not a bird of paradise bird, but a military macaw, one of these beautiful red
Oh,
and
yeah.
green parrots, and so the and she sees birds in paradise. And so there's a triple meaning. So I've given you two meanings, but there's a third one that we won't discuss.
All right. Well, you know what? I was thinking that they do remind me of origami in a way.
Yeah, they
You
do. I mean,
know?
yeah, you can definitely see that on the cover, the way that it looks like folded pieces of paper. Yeah.
They've got to be related to canna lilies. I was just thinking that too. Now I'm in my garden brain now. I'm a botany person. I'm into, Don't ask me all the names, but I just love plants,
Well, this is
So.
what I love about back to the botanic gardens behind you there, because that was one of, it still is my favorite place in Singapore. I lived about a mile from there, and so does Ashlyn when she moves to Singapore. And it's such a beautiful place. And if it weren't so hot, I would just spend a lot of time wandering through those gardens. You know, it's a couple hundred acres of beautiful trees and plants and flowers, and the biggest orchid garden anywhere.
Oh,
So it's amazing.
see, that ties into Georgia O'Keeffe too. She did a lot of orchids, even though she was, New Mexico, but she also painted skyscrapers in New York City. And we went to her museum a few years back, right before COVID. We went to her museum in Santa Fe, and I'd like to go to Abiquiu, out in northern New Mexico, where her summer home was, or is it her winter home or summer home? Yeah, summer home, Abiquiu and Ghost Ranch, where she lived. She had a vegetable garden, and now they have a cooking school for her. I mean, it's amazing how much. And I think they're getting bigger. They're doing a new museum for her in Santa Fe as well. But we always think, oh, it's always flowers, and no, it's not all about the female part either, by the way, everyone, as I learned being there. But she was into, I think she was really into reincarnation. And it kind of makes sense to me because of her living in Santa Fe. And Santa Fe was always about, they celebrate death in such a good way, just like New Mexico. I mean, Mexico. When you go to, I mean, the Mexico cultures and traditions is so prominent, but then you also have the Spanish and you have the European and you had colonization there too. So it's kind of this rebirth, renewal, death kind of thing that's always going on in Santa Fe in their celebrations. And I think, she was so interested in, she was painting death a lot, death and flowers. So I think it was like a rebirth thing. I don't know. But, I'll ask her if she can hear me, like, hey, Georgia. Who knows?
If she believes in reincarnation, maybe she's already back. So.
Well, but that's the thing about art. If you go to a museum, an art museum with a friend or something, you're going to see this one thing have this idea, and they're going to see something completely different. I remember in school, I was all in English and poetry and everything, and we had to write about what this poem meant to us or what it was about. And I wrote it, and the teacher told me, no, that's not what it's about. And I didn't last very long in that class. I got in trouble because I basically said, well, screw you. This is what it is to me. And if this is what it is to me,
Right.
that's what it is. And he's like, no, but this is what the poet wrote it for and what it's about. So you didn't get it. And I'm like, maybe it was just a press release. How do you know? It was an ancient poet. I can't remember who, what, and where, but I remember going like, don't tell me what it is. It's like if I read your book and this is what it means to me, that's what it means to me, period.
Absolutely. That's why I can't, I never answer the question, what does it mean? It means whatever you think it means. So.
Yeah, and we need stuff like that now. Our brains need it because we have too much on our phones telling us what everything means. I think the arts, I love that you tie that in. But before you go, what is next? All right, come on. I know your fingers are doing more typing on things.
Yes.
Do you type everything, or do you handwrite, or do you speak it out? Like, do you do your voice to text?
I type everything. I type way faster than I can handwrite. So to keep up with my brain, I have to type. I don't dictate anything yet, but I think that world is coming. It's getting better. The software is there for that now. So I may move in that direction. But I'm working on a project that I've had to put aside when this book came out in February, and I have a lot to do when a book comes out. So
Sure.
I put this aside. But a couple of years ago, I made a visit to Austria, and then last year I visited Berlin. And so I've become very interested in some European art and music that is
Ooh.
really the seed for this new project, which is really
Ooh.
hard to explain, but it might be an allegory of something, but in a different style than I'm accustomed to. So less realistic, really, and more not fantasy exactly, but and less what florid and more spare, I think. I've been reading a lot of work by people like Annie Ernaux and Jenny Erpenbeck, and Peter Stamm, who is a Swiss writer. And all of these people have a style that's really very different. So the European spareness really appeals to me. And so that's what I'm trying to do in this new
Oh,
project.
wow. That's going to be interesting because you have a textured, yeah, your writing is so, it gets you in, but you feel like there's a texture. Like Ashlyn, you had her like touch her, in her pocket. What is she feeling? And, there's this texture where you can harmony, you feel like you're her. You know what I mean? And I think that's a very, and you can't write that and be, you can't flower things. So you're not flowery. So this is going to be interesting to see. Yeah, this is going to be interesting because, I want to see how this goes. Yeah, I'm interested in this because I don't think you're flowery. I think you're the opposite. I think you're already kind of what you're talking about, but you have a way with words that you're already there. So
I think that's, I'm happy to hear you say that. I think that that's true. Just as an example of what I'm attempting to do right now is, for example, my characters don't have names. And I haven't named the city where they live or even the country where they live. When I get a little further into the project, that all of that may change, but just it's a different approach, maybe more impressionistic than realistic.
Ooh. Well, I'm excited. That's cool. It's exciting to do something different, huh?
Yeah,
Just kind of
definitely.
like switch gears and go, okay, now what happens? You know?
Right.
Hey, Seinfeld started as a show about nothing. So there you go. There you go.
Right.
Well, always a pleasure having you on the show, Cliff. Everyone, CliffordGarstang.com is the website to go to. And The Last Bird of Paradise, it is out now. So again, CliffordGarstang.com. Follow him on Facebook as well. Thanks again so much for joining us.
Thank you, Lisa. It's been a pleasure as always. Thanks so
Thank
much.
you. And next time you talk to us, what we'll all be, 5 years younger, right?
Right.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio. Keep up with our shows at bigblendradio.com.